I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi there, welcome back once again to I Never Thought It Would Happen, brought to you by my good self, Chris Difford, and the wonderful charity Help Musicians. I'm delighted to say on this episode, I'm going to introduce you to a singer-songwriter from Scotland who was inspired to make her own music after seeing the band Travis. She signed a record deal in her teens, and This Is The Life, her first album, sold 3 million copies. Bloody Nora. Since then, she's toured with Paul Weller and worked with Ray Davies and performed with Rod Stewart at the Commonwealth Games. To bring things up to date, she's soon to release album number 6. So let me introduce you to Amy MacDonald. Hi, Amy. Welcome to Help Musicians podcast. Are you aware of the Help Musicians podcast?
I am, yes. I had heard of it previously, and then obviously I got the email to ask if I'd like to participate, and obviously said yes.
Oh, that's very kind. Help Musicians is a wonderful charity, and they really help sort of people that are down on their luck in the music business. During COVID, they gave over £20 million to young people that were suffering, well, young and old, actually. Extraordinary when you think about it.
It is. I mean, we all take music for granted, really, but it's kind of with us through every memorable part of our lives. And to just have it as such a meaningful occupation, but to not properly support the people that make it seems absolutely crazy.
Yeah. I mean, music's like a language all of itself that we all can understand. We don't have to read books to understand it particularly.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's all encompassing for everyone.
Yeah. And you're one of those lucky people that sent in a demo to get a record deal. These days, that doesn't happen. How did that feel?
I know. Like, I think even back then, it was something that didn't happen. It was all MySpace was the new thing at that point.
MySpace,
yeah. So everybody was uploading their songs onto MySpace. And I seen an advert in the back of the NME, actually. And it ended up that I signed to a production company through that. And then, honestly, like a year later, I was in the offices of all the major labels in London and they were courting me. And it all came from sending that demo in. So it is one of these things that definitely doesn't happen now. But even back then, I think they were a bit surprised by it all.
I can imagine. What's your relationship like with the music industry now?
It's actually fine now. I think from the very beginning, when I was really young, obviously I was starting out, I was only 18 when I signed. And I came from a little small town outside of Glasgow. I didn't really have any knowledge of the industry or how anything worked. So I did feel a bit like a fish out of water. And there were things that I just kind of went along with because I thought, oh, this must be how it is. So don't ask questions, just do it. But I've been very lucky, I think, because I always wrote all my own songs, even from the first time I signed with a full album ready to go. So because I've always done it myself, I think there was always that respect that I just had to be left to go away and write my songs and do my thing. So I definitely haven't had it as hard as some people have.
Yeah. What was inspiring you at that time to write your first collection of songs?
everything and anything, really. Being young. Yeah. Being young, the great things that you do when you're young. I was initially inspired by Travis. It was their album, The Man Who, that made me want to play the guitar. So I think I just wanted to emulate Fran Healy and just write songs like he did. And that's kind of how I started. And I would write songs about my friends, about situations we got ourselves in, about nights out and all the things that we all get up to when we're young.
Yeah, oh my God. And did you work with Travis?
Very early on, I got asked to support them. And it was very strange to me because I had been that person that was in the front row at their gigs. I even featured on their live DVD that they released because I was right in the front singing my heart out. So then going on to doing a gig alongside them felt very, very strange. And I've met them loads of times since and they're absolutely lovely, but it always just feels really weird to me. I don't ever feel like I'm on that level. I still feel like the young girl looking up to them on the stage, and I think it'll always be like that.
Yeah, I know how that feels. Were your parents very supportive?
They were. Again, they didn't really have a clue what was going on. I was still really young at that time. They definitely did have a little bit of kind of fear about what might happen, but because I was so young, it felt like I had time to go and give it a go, and if it didn't work out, then I could go back and go to university or do whatever I wanted to do. So I think that they just realised it was something that I really wanted, so they were happy to get behind me and give me that support.
Were there musicians in the family? I think your father was, wasn't he?
My dad always, he had a guitar and he played the guitar, but he's never done it properly. It was just always in the background playing little ditties and things like that, so nothing proper. There was never any coaching or anyone kind of guiding me. I just kind of done it all off my own back.
Yeah. And what sort of music were they listening to when you were a young child, as it were?
The one song that I always remember is Octopus's Garden.
No.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Because my dad would always sing it to my sister and I, so that's always in my head. And another one that I remember is We Didn't Start the Fire by Billy Joel. That was that record was in the car constantly.
Fantastic.
They were the things that I remembered. And then for me, I remember my grandmother actually gave me a gift. I was probably about 4 years old, and it was a cassette tape of the greatest hits of the Beach Boys.
Wow.
So I had a bit of everything going on when I was young.
That's good though. Beach Boys, the harmonies, well, wow.
Yes, I mean, I still listen to a lot of them songs now.
Yeah. So what was the first gig you went to see, do you think?
The first gig I went to see was actually Michael Jackson.
What?
Yes, at Wembley Stadium.
Wembley Stadium, yeah.
Yeah, my mum worked in a bookies at the time, and nobody had touch-tone phones in their house at this point, but because my mum was in the bookies, they had it in there. So she got through on the phone right away and secured the tickets, the good old days where you had to do it on the phone or queue up outside a shop.
Yeah.
So she got the tickets, and I remember we'd done a big road trip down to London. I remember getting stuck in a horrendous traffic jam where it was just standstill.
No. Oh, no.
Yeah, but we got there, and I don't have that many other memories. I was so young at the time, and I remember getting a T-shirt, but I was only like 4 or 5. It was absolutely massive on me. And my mum remembered recently that she thinks it's in a box in the loft, so it might finally fit me.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I mean, it's difficult when you're that young to remember what those kind of shows were, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and like Michael Jackson's show would have been an absolute spectacle. So I think there was probably so much going on for my eyes to take in at that age.
But it seems now, you know, big shows in arenas, and particularly with lots of female artists, which is brilliant, they have so many dancers and choreography and, you know, lights. It's like Billy Smart's circus. It's completely gone mad. Do you like to keep it simple, or do you have that kind of thing going on
as
well?
No, I'm as simple as they come. I had to be convinced recently to have some video on the back screen behind me. I'm happy with a sheet up there. So I think just when I've went to see bands, like, I'm just there for the music, and I actually really don't care that much. Now, I know it does make a difference, and the lights and everything do add to your experience, but I've always been of the mindset that the music should be kind of right at the forefront. That's what it should all be about.
Absolutely. And how do you look after yourself when you're on tour? It's quite a tricky process for some anyway.
It is. I mean, for me, it's the talking I need to rein in. Like, I talk so much. And it's like, you come off stage and you're having these deep and meaningful chats, and then I think, well, I should stop talking. I need to give my throat a bit of a rest. Thankfully, I'm not a mad party animal anymore. Maybe back in my 20s, but now I'm way more interested in sleeping and watching TV shows and stuff. So it's not that difficult. I just need to make sure that I'm not talking, because I get very animated and I can get quite loud. And that's not great for the old throat.
Yeah, I saw Robbie Williams, and he, in a two-hour show, I think he spoke for over half an hour of the two-hour show, which is quite a lot.
Yes. I mean, I've definitely got that in me as well. I learned it off of Fran Healy. I used to love in Travis shows that he would tell these stories in the middle of the show, and I've started doing that, and sometimes you just get away from yourself and you don't even know what you're talking about anymore.
Yeah, I do the same thing, but that's because, you know, I'm not as good a singer as you, but I like to tell tales, and that fills in the gaps, I think.
It does. And I think people really like it. From conversations I've had with people that come to my shows, they really like that part of it, because it feels really intimate and it feels real. It's like you're just there having a conversation with your pals, really.
Yeah, how many people are in your band when you go on tour these days?
So there's myself, and then there's five musicians. Mm-hmm. I remember when I started out, there was only like four of us. So mm-hmm. we've grown a little bit, but not too much. If my band had their way, there would probably be about 10 of us and somebody for every job.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just keep it like that. It seems like the perfect number.
And you go to America or Europe?
Europe predominantly. I haven't really spent any real amount of time in America. Went over at the start of my career a couple of times, but kind of just focused on Europe more than anything. I've been very lucky that I've had good support in places like Germany and Austria, Switzerland, all these great places to visit.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're writing, where do you go in your head?
It can vary, really. If I'm just doing it on my own, I'm kind of more thinking of trying to make the words make sense rather than thinking overly what it's about. And sometimes I don't realise until after the fact, oh, this is what I was thinking of there. If I write with some of my bandmates, which I've done more recently, we very much kind of have a chat beforehand and decide what we're going to write about and have certain ideas in our head. Like my most recent single that I put out was actually inspired from seeing all the incredible videos of U2 performing in the amazing big venue in Las Vegas.
I saw that.
Yeah, I was just completely blown away by the imagery. It was just incredible. And I was thinking about that, and I was writing with my drummer at that point, and I was telling him about these videos, and I showed him, and we were just talking about how amazing live music is. Like, it's something that could never really be replicated. You can't ever get that feeling unless you're there in that moment, and that's kind of what the song ended up being about. So whilst I was writing that, I was just putting myself in the zone of being on stage in front of a great audience. So it can just vary.
Absolutely. And have you written with other people outside of the band?
Once. I'm actually incredibly shy, and I find the whole writing with people you don't really know a very strange thing. It was even hard for me to write with my band at first, because it's like you've got these ideas and they feel like they're very intimate to you, and then you've got to put them out there and hoping that somebody likes them. But I've written one song with the producer who produced half of my new album. Mm-hmm. So I wrote one song with him, and that's the only person that's ever been involved outside the inner circle, really.
Yeah. Oh, well, I run these songwriting retreats in Somerset at Glastonbury.
Oh, wow.
And you'd be more than welcome to come there and put your shyness to one side. You'd really love it.
I mean, it does sound great. It's one of those things that I'd probably be fine once I've done it, because I was nervous even with my bandmates. But once I've done it, it's fine. And it was actually a really refreshing experience, like not feeling like all the pressure is on you. But I'm such a shy, nervous person that I always feel like I'm just winging it. And I think, oh God, I've got nothing to offer. These people can do better than me.
And does your management and like your label push you in any directions, or are you in control of all of that stuff?
I'm very much in control. I think I'm very grateful that I am. I've never really had to have any strange discussions or feel like I'm being pushed in any way or anything. I kind of just go away and write all these songs and say, here you go. And everybody goes, great, let's get to work.
That's good. That's really good. Who do you lean on in times of, when you're kind of down and not feeling like you want to do what you do? Is there someone in particular that you can turn to?
I'm very lucky. I do have a lot of people that I can turn to. Probably my mum is my kind of biggest confidant. She's the person that I always need to seek her approval, and I always want to tell her everything first. So she's probably the most important. My dad as well, but I'm always texting my mum constantly. But in terms of in my job, my manager, Chris, actually started out as my guitar tech back in 2007.
Really?
So he was my guitar tech in 2007.
Amazing.
And then the first tour I went on was supporting Paul Weller just around Europe, I think 2008. Yeah. We had no money, so it was, let's save as much money as possible. So Chris ended up doing the guitar tech, and Andy was tour manager for that gig. And from that moment on, we were like, oh, well, he's great, tour manager. So he then was promoted. And then about 10 years ago, I needed new management. And I said to him, just jokingly, do you want a promotion? And he laughed it off, but I was like, I'm being serious. So he got promoted. So we do joke now that there's only one more promotion left, and that's my job. we'll see. But he's probably one of my closest friends, and we've done this together now since the beginning through all different stages. So he's somebody that I know I can always rely on as well.
Oh, God, I love him. I love him already just by hearing that story.
You will. Everybody loves him. He's just one of those people that everybody loves. Yeah. Damn him.
So you did a little bit of work with Ray Davis, and I've only met him once, and he had an incredible bit of advice for me. What sort of advice did he give you, or did you just write a song or sing with him?
So he was making an album, basically reworking a lot of his classic songs, and he had invited so many amazing musicians, like Bruce Springsteen was on there, Metallica. And then he asked me, which I was like, oh my gosh, like me. So I was very, very nervous. And they had asked if I would do Dead End Street with him. Mm-hmm. So we went to the studio, we sat and chatted. He basically had to rework the whole song to make it fit for both of our vocals. And it was just really, really, he was so chilled out. And it was one of those, we recorded it really quickly. At the end, he had wanted to do some talking over it, like that we would chat over it. And I was trying to tell him that it was making me think of that terrible Michael Jackson and Paul McCartney song where they argue with each other.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, Michael, she's most definitely mine.
Yeah, oh my God.
Yeah, and I was like, this is what this is making me feel like. It's a bit awkward. But we'd done it and it sounded really cool. And for me, it's one of those things that at the time, I was so young, and I was just like, oh, I just need to do this. And you do it and you don't actually appreciate how amazing that is. Like, just what an incredible songwriter, what a kind of musical legend. So it was something I was very, very happy to be part of. And like, when I see the album now still, I think how random that somehow me, I've ended up on there with all of these greats.
So that was at Conk, was it?
Yes, it was.
It's a funny old place, isn't it? There's a lot of wood in that building.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a long time ago. I can't really remember it.
Just reminded me of being in a cupboard or something. It's just like wood everywhere. But not nice wood, just like really silly wood. You know, I don't know. Hi, I'm Chris Difford, and you're listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen. Coming up next, I'm answering your questions.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This is a question for Chris. Hello, Chris. I really enjoyed the TV series Cradle to the Grave. I absolutely loved the album of the same name. It's so varied. Well, it is, isn't it? I'm really interested in this collaboration. As the lyric writer for Squeeze, you were given the rough outlines of narratives for your songs based on the TV series by Danny Baker's book. Did you take certain phrases and use them in the songs? Did it make harder or easier for you to work with the existing storyline? Thanks, Annie. It's a good question, and it didn't really take any of the lines from the book at all, but I took all the inspiration from meeting with Danny and hanging out with Peter Kay. It was a very easy album to write in many ways, and I think it's beautifully produced. And it's really a successful record in my mind, and a successful TV show. It's a shame it didn't come back for a second series, but there you go. I hope I've answered your question, Annie. When you started out, and I guess a long time before that, when I started out, you know, records would sell bucket loads. You know, people would buy them at a record shop, and it was very much a different time. And now, of course, with the internet and streaming, it's a different environment. How have you managed to cope with that change?
It is hard, and I do feel like every time I bring out a new album, the landscape has completely changed again. Yeah. And we're now doing something different. Like this time, it was, oh, you need to put out about 5 singles before you put an album out. And that just feels strange to me, because me personally, the excitement I get from getting an album is sitting down and hearing all these new songs that I've not heard yet. So to release half of it before it's even out seems a little bit counterproductive to me personally. So we did meet in the middle. We decided 3 would be the number for me. But it has changed every single time, and every time you're trying to get used to it. And there's just so much data now that you get access to all of these numbers and percentages and all of that. Sometimes it's just too much. I do long for the days where it was just go into a shop and buy the CD. And I think streaming is amazing in that it can open your music up to people that might never hear it otherwise. But then on the other hand, artists don't really get paid properly from it.
No.
And secondly, it's made music more throwaway, that people just kind of listen to one song or add one song into a playlist and don't really go and check out anything else. And that's something that I've found quite annoying, actually, because you get all this data and it tells you you've got these super listeners that listen to nothing but you. And even trying to just get them to listen to new songs is a real struggle at times. Whereas before it was like, here's my album, and people would go and buy it and listen to the whole thing and enjoy it. And it does feel a shame that we've kind of lost that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, just recently, last year, I remember reading that Rod Stewart had to do these small gigs around London to sell vinyl copies of his album. He'd sign them just to get a number one record. And yet back in the day, Rod Stewart would never have gone anywhere near a small club to sell records.
Yeah, I mean, Rod Stewart, just absolute musical legend, and he's kind of having to do the same that we're all having to do.
Do you? Yeah,
it's just about what's popular on the internet that seems to be what does well these days, which is a shame, really.
I know, and but it is, you know, it's your shop window, I guess, at the same time, and I think that can be rewarding for younger artists. It seems like Instagram is, I've been watching recently a girl on Instagram, and she promotes herself like three times a day with a different record, you know. It just seems mad.
Yeah, I mean, I do look at a lot of the younger artists in complete awe how they can have the time to do all of these videos. My management will say to me, right, can you record an acoustic version of whatever song and record the video so we can use it on Instagram and social media? And it's like a full day event for me, having to set up a camera and everything, set up a microphone, get it sounding right, and then edit it down. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, like I'm so out of touch here. They can just do it at the drop of a hat.
I know. And TikTok, you know, it's a different language. However, you know, a band like ours, for instance, we played a gig in Atlanta a couple of years ago, and we didn't recognize our audience. They were so young, and they must have listened to us on Spotify. Have you found your audience changing at all?
Yes, I've found the exact same thing. And I think that's the side of streaming, which is amazing. And I think that's why albums from the past are having a real resurgence. The amazing one for me was when Kate Bush Running Up That Hill was used on the TV show, and suddenly she's hugely successful and everybody's streaming her music.
Yeah.
Being able to go back and discover music that's maybe before you were born even. So I'd done a festival in Glasgow called Transmit, and I kind of took a little peek out into the crowd beforehand and panicked, thinking 15 years old, they weren't even born when this album came out. This is going to be terrible. And it ended up being one of the best gigs I've ever done. They knew all the words. They had such amazing youthful exuberance. They gave me so much back. And I think that's a side that's came from songs doing well on TikTok. It's just introduced my music to people that might never have come across it otherwise. So that side of it is obviously a real positive. It means that you can reach way more demographics than you were previously. And my main listeners were always people that were my age or older. And it's completely flipped on its head. My main kind of listener group now are females under the age of 24. Which is pretty cool for me to be catching that young female generation. It's amazing to be able to be an artist that they like to listen to.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? And it seems like there are more females in the charts or on playing live shows than there ever was, which is great news.
Oh, it totally is. Like, it's really amazing just to see. It's always been harder for female artists. I remember hearing a statistic way back when that female solo artists sell less merch than any other kind of artist or band going.
Yeah.
And I feel like now that's probably flipped a little bit, and it's really nice to see. It's really refreshing, and it's great to see young women supporting other young women, and I'm very much here for that.
Yeah, the Ivor Novello's was full of female names up for awards, which was amazing, you know. And every day you look in on the internet and it's just girls, 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 which is great.
Yes, it totally is. It totally is. I love it.
Yeah, I got very bored with balding men playing songs very earnestly on stage.
Oh, yeah.
With their bellies sticking out.
I was a bit fed up of the kind of constant sad songs as well. There was a lot of ballads going on at one point. So it's nice that the young women are just coming up with these kind of cool little anthems that you can tap your toes to.
It's like a generation of minor key.
Yes,
everybody
totally
was in the minor key for a couple of years. It's like, come on, guys, wake up. Do you appreciate, you know, the kind of rewards that there are, you know, is the reward for you like it is for me just being there?
I think so, yeah. I feel very, very lucky. Just only the weekend there, I'd done my first festival of the year, and just being on a lineup with kind of loads of other cool acts just makes me feel really proud of myself. And being able to go on stage, and there's always loads of people that don't have a clue who I am and probably go, I've never heard of her. But knowing that I've got it in me to kind of bring them round, I love that side of it. And I do always feel really proud of myself when I'm able to kind of go up there and do my thing. And people might not expect it. And I think that sometimes that's even better because they don't expect it and you win them over anyway.
Yeah. When do you think the passion for writing began? Was it at school?
It was definitely at school, at primary school.
Primary school, right.
Yeah, and my sister, the first one, my sister had this little keyboard that you could just like press one note and it would change the chord and you would have the tune in the background. And I wrote an entire song about a teddy bear that she desperately wanted, but my mum told her she couldn't have. And I think her and me, we still remember all the words to it. So that was probably my first foray into writing. And then after that, I'd taught myself the guitar when I was about 12. I wrote my first proper song on guitar, which was called The Wall. At that point, I wasn't aware of the Pink Floyd song called The Wall.
No, of course not.
And this one was slightly different. This was about my sister's love for Ewan McGregor, who was in posters all over her wall.
Of course, yeah. Good-looking man.
Yes, yes. Well, she loved him. So the song was about how this man was everything to her, but he didn't know that she existed.
And still, to this day...
He doesn't, but he maybe doesn't. He will now. He might listen to the podcast.
That's amazing. So your first guitar, was it your father's guitar or was it something that you bought yourself?
No, so the first guitar I taught myself on was one of my dad's. And then when I could play more than one chord, my dad bought me one as a birthday present. And that was that, really.
Oh, that's good. So what's your ambitions at the moment? Is it just to go on tour, release your album and be yourself?
Pretty much. I'm actually not hugely ambitious. I was ambitious to a point, and I've joked about this with my mum and my sister because we figured out we're all the same, that we're ambitious to kind of get to this point and then just coast. So we'll do all of the hard graft at the beginning so that we can chill out in the middle. And I think that for me is just that I love being able to go on tour. I love performing with my band. I love writing and just hoping that people hear these songs and they like them. I've never had any desire to be known all over the world. And in fact, I think that would probably be the worst thing ever. I like that I can have my kind of anonymous life, but still go on stages and perform at the same time. I think I've got a good balance, so I'd happily just keep that balance as it is.
Oh, yeah. And do you have any things that you do before a gig that kind of centres you?
We don't. Myself and my band always have a little sing-song before a gig. I don't really get massively nervous. I get really nervous if I'm doing something on TV when I know it's live and there's people watching. Mm. But when it's an actual gig, obviously I worry about getting everything right, and when you're playing new songs, you're a bit more anxious about it. But I don't get massively nervous, because some of the biggest cheers I've ever had at concerts is when I stopped halfway and said, sorry, I made a mistake. But we just have a little sing song. We get the guitar out, we sing some fun tunes. We started the gig that we'd done the other day. We actually decided that we were going to attempt Chain Reaction by Diana Ross. Ooh. Which is not the easiest song to sing. So
we'll
that one will be getting shelved.
Yeah.
No. But yeah, so we just have a little sing song and then we wish each other good luck and then on to the stage. Nothing more interesting than that, really.
There's a lot of camaraderie with you and the band then, by the sound of it.
Yeah, there is. It's very much a team effort. Although it might be my name on the tickets or whatnot. I'm very much aware that without my amazing musicians and my band, I wouldn't be able to do this. So I'm always very thankful to them for everything that they do, and always make sure they know that they're part of everything.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. And where's the largest gig you're going to do on this tour?
So the largest gig that I'll do is at the Hydro in Glasgow.
Beautiful, yeah.
Yeah, I'm very lucky that my beautiful city people have stuck with me all this time, so I'm able to do that great kind of big show after all these years. I didn't really expect to still be doing this after all this time, so it's a real privilege that I'm still able to get people to come out and see me.
That's amazing. It's a great place to play, apart from if you're in the traffic trying to get in or out. It's the worst place for traffic around there.
Oh, it is. It's terrible. It's so busy and there's absolutely no cohesion. But as an artist, it's amazing just being on that stage and having all of them people out there. And because it's my home city as well,
of course,
it just means so much.
Oh, that's great. Well, but when does your tour start?
So I've got a load of summer shows throughout Germany and some festivals and stuff, and then my tour starts in the UK in the autumn, and then we go right through until next year through Europe. So
God, you're busy.
My diary's, yes, it's filled already, but it's good. It's been a while. With my last album, we had so much disruption with the pandemic everything that we never got to tour properly. So it's good to be able to finally do it again and know that you're going to go and see all the lovely people that we missed out on the last time.
Yeah, and of course, without, you know, the huge record sales that we all once enjoyed, touring is the income, really. It's the way that we keep ourselves alive.
Yeah, it totally is. I think I was right at the end of the land where we used to sell albums. I think I was probably one of the last kind of the last ones that was able to sell a few, so I'm thankful for that. But yeah, like you say, constantly being out on the road, doing the festivals, doing the gigs is how you make money these days.
Yeah, well, good luck on the road. Keep safe.
Oh,
I must come and see you. That would be amazing. I'd love to meet you in person. That would be brilliant.
Please do.
I'll look at your tour dates. And thank you so much for spending some time on the Help Musicians podcast. They'll be thrilled. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Well, I really enjoyed my chat with Amy. She's so sweet and vibrant, I have to say. She seems very at ease with the music business and all the things that seem to come her way, which I think is an attribute. So hopefully, she can inspire some young women to pick up the guitar and write their own songs. Anyway, that was a lovely chat. And I hope you listen to all of the podcasts for Help Musicians. And if you do, please subscribe. If you want to know more about the amazing work that Help Musicians does, then take a look at their website, follow them on social media like I do, and please consider donating a little money to the charity. They do incredible work supporting musicians of all types across the UK, changing people's lives for the better. And don't forget, I'm taking your questions from writing, recording, touring, and everything in between. Send your questions to chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. That's chris@helpmusicians.org.uk. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.